I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week in Nevada, Hillary Clinton called out Donald Trump in a speech that said he was taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the GOP. She was referring to an online movement that calls itself the alt-right. Here's what she said.
This is not conservatism as we have known it. This is not republicanism as we have known it. These are racist ideas, race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-women, all key tenets making up the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right. Now, alt-right is short for alternative right.
We have someone from the Wall Street Journal to tell us more about the alt-right, reporter Beth Reinhart, who has been covering the presidential campaign. And Beth, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
So how does the alt-right describe itself?
The alt-right or the alternative right describes itself in a lot of different ways because it's a pretty loosely organized movement with a lot of different views. But I would say these are folks who see immigration and multiculturalism as threats to white identity. There's definitely a racially tinged part to this movement. They are anti-free trade. They're anti-immigration, which, of course, you know, lines up with those are two of the main themes of Donald Trump's agenda.
When we talk about or you talk about an online movement is it organized? And I know it largely lives online, but I think there are also some certainly at least a think tank associated with the alt-right.
There is a think tank. The man who's credited with starting the movement or coming up with the term is Richard Spencer. He is associated with the National Policy Institute. That's a think tank. But for the most part, the alt-right is made up of young white men who are very active on social media. You know, that means a lot of websites that most people have never heard of, as most people have never heard of the alt-right, on Facebook, on Twitter. That is where the alt-right mostly lives.
You have described the alt-right as it promotes nationalism, it rejects mainstream conservatism, sees immigration and multiculturalism as a threat to white identity. Can we say this is a white supremacist group, or is that going too far?
I mean, certainly groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, civil rights groups that track hate groups would call it that. People in the alt-right do not call themselves white supremacists, but they certainly believe that there are differences between races. And so I guess it comes down to a matter of semantics to some degree. Folks who see people who are not white as threats to white identity, white culture, the white race, I mean, you can form your own conclusions about what that means.
What is their problem with the Republican Party, the GOP?
Right. So the one thing that is interesting about the alt-right is if you look at the word alt-right, like alternative right, I mean, they are on the right, but they are not Republicans. They are not conservatives. They are not Tea Partiers. They are not libertarians. I mean, this is a movement that is largely defined about being against certain things. It's very subversive. It's very anti-establishment, which, you know, the anti-establishment part of it also kind of lines up with Donald Trump. You can see why folks on the alt-right would be attracted to Donald Trump, because he's been positioning himself as someone who is against the political establishment.
They have a word. I was almost afraid to say it, but I looked it up, and I can say this. It's called cuckservatives.
Yes.
Can you define that
awkward
for us? Kind of a mouthful there, but go ahead.
Awkward, ugly word that is used to describe, it's sort of a version of rhino. Remember the Republicans in name only? This is sort of the updated, much harsher version of that. Conservatives who are basically sellouts, who are, not true believers, are cuckservatives.
Which is a mix between the word cuckold and conservative, right? Just to
exactly
sort of add to
a man who is being taken advantage of, infuses the meaning of that word.
Are there anti-Semitism? Is anti-Semitism a part of this? And I ask that. There's a meme. It's a green frog with a Nazi insignia. Help us understand that.
I mean, there are a lot of Holocaust deniers on the alt-right. Again, they would probably argue about the use of the term anti-Semitic. But there are certainly a lot of very ugly memes and promoting of Nazism and ideas associated with the with Hitler that are used by the alt-right. You could say at best to just be provocative and at worst to spread hate.
And it largely lives online. Are we likely to see an alt-right movement or group at a demonstration, for instance?
You know, I don't think so much. Actually, when I talked to Richard Spencer, who's, you know, considered the head of the movement, I asked him that question, if he had been to a Trump rally, and he said, no, I probably should get to one. I mean, these are not people that, like, you know, that you see at the rallies for the most part. These are a lot of, in many cases, professionals with jobs, but who have this passion online and spend a lot of time connecting with like-minded people.
Can we say they are Trump supporters, or is that going too far?
Well, in many cases they are, because in Trump they have found someone who embraces some of their core tenets and has gone farther than anyone who embraces their ideas has gone. And he's the nominee of the Republican Party. That, to them, is a huge achievement. Now, you could argue that they are promoting their support for Trump in part to sort of ride his coattails and bring their ideas into the mainstream, as Hillary Clinton argued the other day. Trump has never used the term, as far as I know, in his campaign, you know, as far as his campaign says. And I'm not sure he, you know, would even know what it was, but, you know, he might call it just Trumpism. But, you know, certainly we know his policies don't line up with Republican orthodoxy, and that's been a great achievement for the alt-right in their minds.
Now, this is where it gets a little more complicated. Donald Trump hired Stephen Bannon, editor-in-chief of Breitbart, and Stephen Bannon said that Breitbart is the, quote, platform of the alt-right. What does that tell us, if anything?
I mean, in many people's eyes, it sort of formalized a relationship that had already existed. I mean, Breitbart is very popular among the alt-right. It also happens to be a website that has championed relentlessly Trump's campaign and savaged his critics. And so then when Trump goes and puts the guy in charge of Breitbart, in charge of his campaign, I mean, that certainly sends a powerful message.
Are there ties to Alex Jones? He's got this radio show, a conspiratorial, I should say, radio show. Are there ties between alt-right and Alex Jones?
Do we know? I think so. I mean, you know, all of this, like I said, is very loose. There's no membership fees. There's no sign-up lists. You know, this is a movement that even a year ago, most people had never heard of and still have never heard of. And without Trump's success, I'm not sure we would be talking about them. This is all really new and very much on the political fringes.
Does it have ties? Does the alt-right have ties to, for instance, the KKK? What's left of the KKK?
Well, I mean, I interviewed David Duke, perhaps one of the most well-known former Ku Klux Klan leaders, and he considers himself part of the alt-right. Now, I'm sure if you talk to people in the alt-right, they may have different, you know, different opinions about the Ku Klux Klan. You know, you can say you're a member of the alt-right. No one can stop you.
It's just that loose of an organization.
Right. So, you know, there definitely is a connection, whether it's formal or not, you know, probably not. But there's definitely a lot of overlap, I think.
I'm curious what you think the head of the Republican Party, the more mainstream Republican Party, what they make of the alt-right and whether they see it as a threat to the GOP?
Well, the Republican Party is undergoing implosion right now. I mean, so many of its most, you know, cherished tenets have been challenged by Trump, and yet at the same time, the Republican Party has been forced to embrace Trump to some degree as its standard bearer. When I say the Republican Party, I mean like the national, Republican National Committee, which is, you know, basically running the Trump campaign to some degree as far as, the ground game is concerned. So, they would rather win than not win, obviously. And if that means having a candidate who challenges some of their long-held views on trade, on immigration and taxes, that's the price that they have to pay.
I noticed that some members who say they're part of the alt-right were so happy about all the attention that they've gotten, I guess, since Hillary Clinton made her speech last week. What do you make of that?
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, like I said earlier, they've been on the political fringes. Almost no one has heard of them. Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, who is obviously someone steeped in politics, was asked about the alt-right the other day, and he said, alt-conservative, whatever, and then he was corrected, alt-right, yeah. Like, this is not a household name. And so then to have the nominee of the Democratic Party and the one who's winning, at least right now, devote an entire speech to this movement. It's just been like their baby, so to speak, was a source of great pride for some of the leaders.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and Beth will be picking up with our other two guests who are waiting in the wings here. But are you surprised at the racial turn or the way race was talked about last week by both of the candidates?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I think that if you look at Hillary Clinton's speech, I mean, she built a pretty compelling case against Donald Trump. He's just done and said so many things during this campaign that, you know, at best are extremely insensitive, at worst, showing a lot of bigotry. Trump's case was, I think, not quite as compelling. Calling Hillary Clinton a bigot, I think, is an epithet that I'm not sure a lot of people will swallow, even folks who are not supporters of Hillary Clinton. So, but it's interesting to that he's trying to use that argument, and it's clearly he's looking at the polls and seeing how low he is among blacks and Hispanics and among white people. So he's got to really push up those numbers, and this is one of his strategies of late.
Well, we're going to pick up on that after this very short break. Beth Reinhart, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's been covering the presidential campaign for the Wall Street Journal. Stay with us. We've got two guests who are chomping at the bit, ready to go after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Last week, the race for the White House got racial. Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a bigot and said the Democratic Party uses African Americans to win elections and then abandons them.
I say it again. What do you have to lose? Look, what do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose? And at the end of 4 years, I guarantee you that I will get over 95% of the African American vote. I promise you. Because I will produce for the inner cities. And I will produce for the African Americans. And the Democrats will not produce, and all they've done is taken advantage of your vote. That's all they've done. And once the election's over, they go back to their palaces in Washington, and you know what? They do nothing for you. Just remember it.
Hillary Clinton spoke in Nevada last week, and while she didn't directly call Trump a racist, she said his racial history in real estate and on the campaign trail reinforces harmful stereotypes and is a dog whistle to his most hateful supporters.
He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party. His disregard for the values that make our country great is profoundly dangerous. In just this past week, under the guise of outreach to African Americans, Trump has stood up in front of largely white audiences and described black communities in such insulting and ignorant terms. Poverty, rejection, horrible education, no housing, no homes, no ownership, crime at levels nobody has seen. Right now, he said, you can walk down the street and get shot. Those are his words. But when I hear them, I think to myself, how sad. Donald Trump misses so much. He doesn't see the success of black leaders in every field, the vibrancy of black-owned businesses, the strength of the black church.
James Peterson joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, director of Africana Studies and associate professor of English at Lehigh University. He hosts The Remix on WHYY, his podcast, also a frequent contributor to MSNBC. James Peterson, nice to have you back with us.
Thanks
on Radio Times.
Me.
Also with us is Calvin Tucker, chairman of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council. He was a delegate to the Republican National Convention, a Trump supporter. In fact, we called you, Calvin and Tucker, when you were in Cleveland. Thanks for joining us here in our Philadelphia studio.
Did.
What do you make of Donald Trump's description of African Americans?
Well, I think he hit it right on the mark. I don't think he said anything that's not true. I work in the African American community and the underserved community. I see the devastation economically, the health and wealth disparity, the many problems that we are confronted with. So we need a leader who can address those issues head on and not a political leader who's just going to, debunk those issues and not address them.
How do you see, James, Donald Trump's description of African Americans? We just heard a little taste of it.
Yeah, I mean, as the late, great W.E. Du Bois said, you cannot define a people as a problem. And so if you define the African-American community exclusively by the problems and challenges that are in that community, the poverty and crime, there is more poverty concentrated in the African-American community. There are challenges that are the consequences of long-term institutional and racial biases across this nation. But you can't define the entire black experience that way because, one, what it does is it plays into certain stereotypes and it plays into certain perceptions of black identity that feed institutional racism and oppression. But two, it also ignores the extraordinary contributions that black folks have made to this nation since its inception under the threat and duress of that very, very same oppression. And so it's an unfortunate way to characterize the black experience in America. And I think it's one way of playing to the audiences that he's been sharing that message with up to this point, which has been largely white audiences.
And what do you make of that, Calvin Tucker?
Yeah, I think that is a mischaracterization of Donald Trump's point of view. I work every day in the underserved community. I see the distress, and someone has to address that distress in a serious way. And until we start addressing the issue, you're right, it's maybe 90% of the black community. There are certainly successes that ought to be pointed out as well. But these distresses, for example, here in the city of Philadelphia, we've been run by a Democrat administration for 65 years, and we are the number one poverty city out of the 10 largest cities. I was in Cleveland a couple of months ago, and 76.8% of their residents live in zip codes that are economically distressed. We have to address those issues. I mean, flowery language has been put forth for a long time, but no one is seriously addressing those issues, and I think we need a leader that's going to do that.
What would Donald Trump do for poor communities?
Well, let me see. Donald Trump has been a builder pretty much all his career. His economic platform talked about creating 5.3 million jobs. Now, a rising ship brings all boats to the shore. And I believe that he's also going to reduce the overall tax burden, you know, on individuals from 39.6% down to 25%. Those dollar savings, that 15%, works for African Americans as it does for all citizens. So I think he has an economic message. I think he's a builder. He understands the infrastructure. And we need to, and Democrats have talked about infrastructure projects needs to be done across this country in major urban centers. And he understands those things and all of those things that will help eradicate poverty and unemployment. The solution to that is providing job opportunity.
James, one of the critiques from Donald Trump, go ahead, let me just frame this for you and I'll give you a chance to respond, is that the Democratic Party wants black voters to vote for them. And largely that is the case, certainly here in Philly and, right. and certainly for President Obama and other right. Democrats. But once in office, they turn their back on black people and it's business as usual. What do you say in response to that?
Well, in response to that, there certainly are politicians on both sides of the aisle that disregard black citizens and do it systematically. There are also institutions that, because of their long history, these are educational institutions, health institutions, criminal justice institutions, that have biases that are built in and they've been there for a long time. And you need local political action to really address some of those things systematically, not just at the federal level. But I just want to be very careful about passing off numbers and policy statements from either candidate. In my opinion, I don't think that tax cuts are the way that you address the specific needs of those folks, people of color and white folks, who are poorest in our communities. This idea that somehow when you cut taxes for business owners that those resources trickle down just hasn't happened over the course of the last 30 years or so in the United States. What we need to do is think about strengthening the social safety net. We need to think about what our education policy is. We need to think about reforming criminal justice, the criminal justice system. Those are the things that speak directly to poor folks across racial lines, and we need specific policies to try to get at some of those issues. So I'm not hearing much from either campaign at this point about how you get down to the brass tacks of addressing poverty in our communities. But I don't think that Mr. Trump talking about the pain and suffering of the black community in the way that he's done so up to this point in any way indicates that he will be a leader on the issues that matter to those folks that he's mentioning in some of these speeches.
The interesting thing about that is we're here talking about those issues today. And had he not in the way that we're describing, whether it's sensitive or not sensitive, if he had not brought that issue up, then I don't think you would be devoting a show to
having
a—
That's simply not true. I've been on this show talking about these
issues. Well, no, yeah. I mean, I know.
I have to say, in our defense,
I talk about these issues all the time. By the way, right. I serve the community as well. Right. I talk about these issues all the time. I don't think it's a matter of giving Mr. Trump some points for mentioning the fact that black folks have challenges. We all know those things. The question is what are the specific sort of policies that will get at some of those issues? And for me, tax cuts is not the way that you
Well, no, tax cuts is just one of the issues. But what I'm saying is you work in the black community. Yeah. So what have you done to foster a change in the way we live?
Sure.
That's the important thing.
Can I answer that?
You can.
Number one, I'm an educator, so I volunteer my time. I've volunteered my time in public schools across this state and really across this nation. I think education is one of the big things for me. The other piece for me is I also do a lot of work on reforming the criminal justice system, so I've done quite a bit of work volunteering and visiting and educating folks in prisons as well. Now, again, my individual work is, you know, because just like charity is not just right. My individual work and the time that I put in to try to make changes is not the same as getting the policy formation that we need to address things systematically.
Right.
Let me go back to you, Calvin Tucker. And this is, I think, for people that haven't signed on to Donald Trump, are confused by his talk more recently about race. Now, he hasn't spoken to largely or majority black audiences, and he's been running for president for more than a year.
And I'm not really concerned about that. It's the message. Not where you deliver the message. Democrats have been delivering the message.
The question is, why hasn't he come to Philadelphia, the Church of the Advocate?
Places. Absolutely. He's coming to Philadelphia, and he's going to talk to African Americans and all citizens of this city.
How do we, though, make sense of the fact that he was an outspoken birther? And he challenged the president's birth certificate. He apparently sent investigators to Hawaii to look for this birth certificate. which in many ways was seen as racist on his part, as a way to discredit, on unfounded reasons, discredit right. the President of the United States.
Well, look, I mean, everyone evolves in their own positions.
But this was just a couple of years ago.
Right.
I'm
but,
just saying.
But has he talked about that in this campaign?
He can't I don't talk think about so. It. He would seem as absurd as he did then. But listen, the birther stuff is not the worst racialized past for Donald Trump. Right. It's the discrimination policies. You say he's a builder, but he built homes that he discriminated against African-Americans and Latinos. It's the way that he launched his campaign on this racist, anti-immigration sort of platform. A platform, by the way, that the alt-right is absolutely identifying with, which is discriminating against folks based upon not how they get to the United States, but what they look like when they get here. And
but,
so,
but it is about, but it is about, ahead, it is about winning at the bottom. At the end of the day, it's about winning. When you're running against 17 people or 16 people in the primary election,
you're going to excuse his rhetoric based upon the folks.
No, I'm not going to excuse his rhetoric. What I'm saying to you is, in the political process, everyone has to find their lane. In the political process. And those 17 candidates each had to find their lanes. Some were progressive, some were conservatives, some were less than that. So you had to find your lane. He was an entertainer. He said some outrageous things to get to where he is. But he won overwhelmingly.
This argument is beneath you, sir. It is, because the reality
is, I'm telling you the political reality.
Right,
of this
but that's but it's beneath you to endorse that, because we. And this
I'm
is
not
why
endorsing
people,
it. Okay, okay. I'm telling you what the reality
this,
is,
and this is why people check out of the process.
I've been there for 46 years, okay. So I understand the political process.
This is
ahead,
why
James.
People check out of the political process, because if you're going to say that people for reasons of political strategy take up a particular position, how do we know whether or not a candidate is ever authentic in that position? And I think that critique goes to both sides of the aisle. But sometimes you have to also make an assessment about the extremity of the ideologies purported in the particular messaging. So if someone is preaching hate, and I do believe that those early anti-immigration comments about Mexicans being rapists and all those things is preaching a certain kind of hate. And if you think about the report we had at the top of the show about the alt-right, about a group of Americans, by the way, that alt-right group, although the piece was about them nationally, you have to remember this is an international ideology when you look at what's going on in the UK with Brexit, when you look at Sweden and other parts of Europe where you see white males feeling this kind of angst. If you're playing to that particular group using hate messaging, that's not just the same as
white
a political strategy to try to beat.
But here's the thing. It has always been this way, and until we start having a serious discussion about race at our kitchen tables, at the library, at the schools, we are always going to have this institutional and collective racism that exists in this country. And it didn't start with Donald Trump, or it didn't start with Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton. It is something that has been here, and we need to begin to have a honest discussion.
Well, and I think
about
we could,
race.
I think hopefully the whole country would agree with that, yeah. and we may not be having this particular
right.
serious discussion at this point. But trying to understand both the candidates, and I have a question for you, James. But I'm also looking at you, Calvin. Donald Trump tweeted over the weekend, Dwayne Wade's cousin was just shot and killed walking her baby in Chicago. Just what I've been saying, African-Americans will vote Trump. Criticized for taking a tragedy,
right,
clearly,
right.
and using it as a way to underscore his message right. about African-Americans, which is that they're all just killing each other.
Well, if I was there, I would have...
You would have put the phone away?
Yeah, yeah.
I buried it somewhere,
oh,
maybe?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's an issue should not be in partisan politics whatsoever.
Here's what I would love Mr. Trump to say about Chicago, right? Because obviously that's a political mistake.
Right.
Mr. Trump makes a lot of those.
He's not a politician, so.
Well, he's in the political realm.
But he is now.
Right.
He is now.
He's running.
Well, he's learning about fire.
I would love for Mr. Trump to talk about the availability and accessibility of guns in the city of Chicago. They've collected over 6,000 guns. That's more than L.A. and New York put together, right? So there's a gun problem. He could take on, if he wants to be this sort of outside of the box candidate, take on the NRA and the gun manufacturers, because the reality is we can talk all we want to about what people call black on black crime. Remember, most crime is committed intra-racially anyway, but folks want to say there's a black on black crime problem in Chicago. The things we need to be talking about are education in Chicago and access to guns. Right. And if folks don't want to have that conversation, then you don't really want to solve the problems
in
Chicago.
And guns is not an NRA problem per se.
I used to be
a banker. I ran a bank in the city of Philadelphia. I was the fiduciary for a couple of the city council people and congress people in terms of gun buyback program. And I stood in one of the police precincts, and we got over 200 guns, zip guns, homemade guns, illegal guns that were either bought in the city or outside of the city. So it was not bought necessarily from a manufacturer, but those guns had to originate from somewhere. So those issues are not just NRA issues. Those issues are social economic issues and issues that we need to address on a local level.
But certainly, we're almost up in a rake here, yeah. But certainly NRA hasn't taken a proactive stance on trying to address that problem in terms of trying to keep guns out of people's hands.
Right. Right.
Can we just be honest about the NRA for a moment? The NRA is essentially a front for gun lobbyists and gun manufacturers. They are partners with gun manufacturers and gun lobbyists to make sure that the kind of policies that plague certain cities. You can have great gun control in a city like Chicago, and when the rules are lax in all the suburbs and all the rural areas surrounding that city, then that renders that gun policy relatively ineffective. You are right, though, that gun buyback programs, ceasefire programs, there are programs that do work, but I'm saying, can we get presidential candidate leadership? Right. Instead of folks saying prayers and all these other things about what happens in Chicago, what about the policies that actually make a difference?
Hold on to that thought, only because they're playing my song, which means we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking about a whole host of things. The fact that last week the race for the White House got racial, and James Peterson hosts WHYY's The Remix podcast. Calvin Tucker, chairman of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco. And just a recap here, Donald Trump is polling in the single digits among black voters. In recent weeks, he's been attempting to increase his low numbers by talking about race, although it should be said largely before white audiences. He did call Hillary Clinton a bigot, said the Democrats have done nothing for African-American voters. She responded with a speech in Nevada outlining Trump's racially charged comments, his actions as a real estate developer, and his alleged ties to the alt-right. And again, talking with James Peterson, the host of the Remix podcast that you can hear at WHYY, and Calvin Tucker, chairman of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy.org. We have an email from Fred. He says, raising the minimum wage, which Clinton supports and Trump does not support, would quickly help so many, especially in the black community. Do you agree with that, Calvin Tucker?
No, I don't, because as you raise the minimum wage, employers and companies are going to look to reduce their total number of employees.
How do you get people out of, especially working poor, which I always sticks in my craw when you say the word working poor, because if you're working, you shouldn't be poor.
You shouldn't be poor, absolutely.
But how do you then increase the wage, if not the minimum wage?
Well, everyone needs a livable wage. If you're working, you need a livable wage. So I believe the best way to do that is to determine the number of employees you have, right, the essential employees you have, and you give them a livable wage.
Like $15 an hour?
$22 an hour.
Whatever the number is.
Whatever the number is.
One quick thing, because folks always say that people are going to lay people off or fire people if we raise the minimum wage. Right. There will be a little bit of that. But you know what else will happen when we actually make wages livable for the working folks in America, is that the folks who are on the lower end of the economic scale actually spend a lot more of their money. Some of those resources will go back into the economy. We can't even see how that will unfold because the policies that are in place right now don't allow us to have a livable wage. So there's two pieces to this. It's not just that there will be some employers who will be a little bit skittish about paying their employees more. It's also that those folks who do that, and the way you do that is you cut executive salaries, by the way. You cut payouts on stock folks, and folks hate that, but that's the reality of how you get a more robust middle-class economy. But that money goes back into the economy when wages go up for poor and working folks.
Well, and hopefully, and that's the problem with creating, and I'm going to go back to the African-American community, when you're trying to create black wealth, and you got to reduce the propensity to consume versus the propensity to save. So any dollars you earn should go into investing and savings, even if you're on the lower end of the scale. If you save more, that at the end of the day, you're going to be valued more in that process.
Let me ask you, and I'm looking, this is from 538, a polling organization, and they looked at the ABC News Washington Post poll. This is just a week or so ago. Trump is fourth place among black voters, behind Clinton at 83%, Gary Johnson at 4%, Jill Stein at 8%, Donald Trump at 2%. How do you suggest that he get more black voters that want to support him?
Well, first off, I don't believe the veracity of the polls.
Nate Silver is
well. I'm looking at I'm well, and the at, reason I'm looking at Fox. I'm looking at Marist. I'm looking at Wall Street Journal, NBC News.
Look,
let's say it's true.
Okay, let me just give you an example. I have played ball with about 25 to 30 guys over the last 30 years, most of whom were Democrats, and I'm the only Republican. it makes for a good match.
I bet it does.
but in any case, over the last couple of months, you know, several of those folks have come to me and says, look, you know, despite what Donald Trump says, he is hitting a chord, and I'm going to support him, but don't say anything about that.
But is it because they're embarrassed by it?
There's a quiet support. Well, first off, you know, a lot of folks are so brainwashed that they can't support a Republican.
Wow.
You know, and that has been the case. I was a delegate in 2012. That was a case with Mitt Romney and a case with John McCain. but I think there's quiet support out there. I remember when there was a poll that showed that in Pennsylvania he had Donald Trump had 0%, and I said to the reporter at the time,
"I think that was me actually."
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
I did.
And I said, "Marty, you didn't call me. Well, they didn't call me, and I think I'm one fraction of 1% of." And I know.
Well, there's always a margin of error.
Yeah, it could still be 0% if you and even the people you're playing basketball with decided they.
Well, no,
to come
but again,
I think Nate Silver does great work, and it's an aggregate poll sort of sample. It's not just one poll that he's talking about. Donald Trump's not doing so well against black folks. I think it's really, we have to be very, very careful about how we characterize the political and intellectual capacity of a particular voting bloc. I mean, people want to say that black folks vote Democratic because they're brainwashed. That's a little bit of an oversimplification. I mean, you have to look at the policies that our bipartisan system has put forth over the last 30, 40 years. And I think there are a lot of folks who vote according to what those policies have been. And so the party that supports social safety net, the party that at least 30 years ago or so was sort of anti-corporate America, is the party that has been winning the black votes in recent memory. You can see progressive blacks start to be very, very critical of the Democratic Party and start to think green and think a little bit more to the left. But that does not mean that the Republican Party or Donald Trump's Republican Party is necessarily the answer for those black
folks. But also,
let me get some callers in. Go ahead, Kevin.
Now, I was going to say that when you break this down and look at grassroots politics, you still have, and I'm talking in the city of Philadelphia, you still have a ward structure, and you got precinct captains, you've got unions that are bringing folks out without regards for policy or, you know, platform. They're bringing folks out to support the candidate that they want, and that has nothing to do with intellectual capital, intellectual understanding of where a candidate is on a certain position. So I would submit that the system, while I may not say rigged, it certainly supports outside of folks working for a policy position.
Although
supporting
Donald
a policy
Trump
position.
Did say that it was, if he loses Pennsylvania, it's because it was rigged.
Right.
He did a whole
He did say
but you're,
that.
But you're saying.
I'm not saying it. I'm not a billionaire, so I can't make those kind of statements.
Interesting. Let me get David from Flemington to join us. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I believe the issues of race in politics in our country have been fueled historically by a primal rural and suburban versus urban fear and antagonism. And I just wanted to know your guest's comment on how that plays in adversely, not just this election, but past ones. Thank you.
Sure. You want to take that, James?
Yeah, this is really complicated. It requires a much longer history. You know, yeah. You have to remember the kind of impact that the GI Bill had. You just remember the impact that black migration to the north has had on our urban centers. And I think when you look at that longer history, the Great Migration, the discrimination in the GI Bill and how our suburbs were developed almost exclusively for white folks at a moment where black folks didn't have access to some of the resources to get out there, there has been institutional racial effects that have impacted the perception of black people based upon whether you live in an urban environment versus whether you live in a suburban or rural one. And so there's a long history that's shaped by policy, the caller is right, that makes those things very, very, very tense. When you think about now in the contemporary moment with gentrification, how schools are funded based on tax bases, there still are policies that unfortunately shape not just where folks live racially, but how folks believe people behave based upon race. And so there's a lot of complications that are informed by policy around these issues.
Let me read a comment from Dale. He says, when are Trump's taxes going to be released? This discussion of race is a distraction. Do you think he should release his taxes, Calvin?
Well, I think he will release his taxes once they have been fully vetted and audited by the IRS.
Apparently, the IRS says he is free to release them or release as many pages as he wants, even though he's being audited. It does, I think, key into this feeling that either he doesn't pay taxes or he hasn't made donations, that maybe he's not the billionaire that he says he is. I mean, the longer he doesn't release them.
Well, I don't want to read anything in it. When we see the taxes, we'll be able to make those value judgments.
Yeah, just so folks understand, if he's not paying taxes, which some people are saying, they should note that that's not really about Donald Trump. That's about our tax code. And there are very, very wealthy folks who are able to circumvent paying their fair share of taxes. I mean, that's a reality we should be thinking about regardless of whether or not Trump releases his tax forms or not.
Let me ask you, James Peterson, about the crime bill. This was signed by President Clinton back in the 1990s. Actually supported, I think, almost half of the Congressional Black Caucus did support it. But it certainly has had either intended or unintended consequences in that many African Americans have ended up in prison because of this crime bill. How much do you think that hurts Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that when there's been great reporting on the internal mechanics of the Trump campaign that suggests that this is what they're actually trying to key in on here, that all this talk about trying to get out to the African-American community will ultimately resolve itself around them laying the crime bill at the foot of Hillary Clinton. I think folks have to go back to the 1990s. Remember, we've had this precipitous drop in violent crime since the 90s. By the way, that's not because of the crime bill. It's because of a whole host of other factors that I won't have time necessarily to get in right here. But there are intended and unintended consequences of that. And I feel like everyone at the presidential level has to be held accountable for that, because and all the folks who support it, that's in the CBC and other entities that support it, have to be held accountable for what has happened, because maybe they couldn't predict how sort of free trade agreements, low economic opportunity, eroding public education, and all those things would feed into the criminal justice system. But certainly folks understood how privatization was going to operate. They also understood that the war on drugs, even by the 1990s, we understood that the war on drugs was a misplaced policy effort and wasn't really bringing down drug abuse. It wasn't really reducing criminality in the communities most plagued by it. So there are things that folks maybe can say, hey, we didn't know about, but there are also some things that folks are going to have to absolutely take credit for. You've seen Hillary Clinton try to sort of perform some mea culpas around this, but the reality is that we still haven't seen from either side here what are going to be the policy remedies for a criminal justice system that's unchecked. We incarcerate more people than any other first world nation in the world. Do we want to be the incarceration nation? That's the question that I want both candidates to be able to answer in this campaign.
Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, no, what I want to weigh in, I recently got a series of calls from one of the major prisons in this state, and it was from some lifers, and they want a review for reforming the lifer statute, and they want to have a vetting of that. They want the legislators to look at that. Because
You know, after they have been in for a period of time, they've served their, they've paid back to society, they've reformed themselves to whatever extent that they've reformed themselves, then there ought to be some consideration for them to be released. And I said to them, absolutely, let's look at this, let's talk to the legislators, and if there's merit there, then we ought to see if we can move this legislation through the House.
Do you think Hillary Clinton's a bigot? When you look at her history, her life, how she talks,
I can't judge that.
Was it a mistake for him to say that? For Donald Trump to say that about her?
Well, I don't think it was a mistake for him to. I mean, based on whatever analysis that they drew from, you know, he can make any statements he wants. It has to be verified. It has to be substantiated. And I don't see the evidence of that. I do remember back in the 90s while the Clintons was running, you know, they used to call him Bubba and good old boy and, you know, all of those issues. So those are codes as well. So, you know, it has to be some validity to those issues as well.
What do you hope? I'm just thinking going forward, we've got three debates. We've got, I think someone, you said 72 days. I guess everyone is counting the days down to early November. I mean, where do you... Where do you think this is going? Where do you want this to go?
Yeah, I would love for it to focus less on the personal sort of attacks. And honestly, I don't care if Trump or Clinton are personally bigoted. What I care is what are the policies that they're invested in and what they've supported over the long arc of their political or professional careers. What I hope we'll see going forward is a robust conversation about how we get our public education system back on track. And I'm not talking about school choice here. I'm talking about a robust plan to really reinvigorate our public school system across this nation. I hope we have a very, very complex and heartfelt conversation about how we reform our criminal justice system. And I hope we have a very, very serious conversation about how do you get Congress to work with whoever the president is to actually implement these infrastructure bills that the Obama administration has been trying to put into place for some time now. I think if I don't think any of those three things are going to happen, Marty, but you're asking me what I'd like to see. Those are the three things that I'd like to see.
I'd like to see a robust discussion and then action on addressing the problems we confront every day in the urban community, in the African-American community, because those problems have existed for a long time. And if we don't start resolving them, many of the problems manifest themselves in social economic issues and the criminal justice issues that, you know, my friend is talking about. So if we don't have that discussion, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, we're going to be sitting here talking about the same issues, the race issues. We got to have a serious discussion about race, and it shouldn't be centered around a campaign or, you know, at one point.
I often wonder whether a campaign is the worst time to have a conversation about race. I mean, something as with such deep history and such power.
Yeah.
Well, we could go on. I got to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Calvin Tucker, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Chairman of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council. He was a delegate to the Republican National Convention earlier this summer, and he is a Donald Trump supporter. James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. Check out his podcast. It's called The Remix. You can hear it at WHYY. He's also a frequent contributor to MSNBC. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.